another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM People Powered Radio. I am your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's episode is entitled Iconic Demonic. Ladies and gentlemen, strap yourselves in for a Sacred Cinema first, a world first, a universe first. This is the first ever episode of Sacred Cinema where we are going to talk about a television show. Well, not really. We're talking about the new season of Black Mirror, and technically all of the episodes are films, but I want to draw this line in the sand and say this is the first time ever on Sacred Cinema we're actually going to talk about a TV show, which we never talk about. I don't actually watch that much TV, so it's a big deal for Mr. Charlie Brooker to get me sitting down in front of the idiot box watching television. Why are we talking about the new season of Black Mirror? Well, a couple of reasons. I feel like it's getting a lot of unfair, poor reception. I mean, they've been out for quite a while now, and I've talked to a few friends about it. I've read up a little bit, not too much. About it. I like to keep the takes fresh here on Sacred Cinema. And I just feel like people aren't getting around it nearly as much as I would have liked. I really enjoyed maybe most of the episodes. There's a couple I was a bit like, eh, and you'll find out which ones in just a moment. But I also thought maybe a bit more than other seasons, there was some kind of like more prominent through lines in a lot of the films, which makes it a little bit more like a TV show, if you like. And I really wanted to talk about some of the through lines that we picked up on. So that the three films we're actually going to talk about, the first one's going to be Maisie Day, which was directed by Uta Brisewitz. We're then going to move on to Demon 79, which I think is technically a Red Mirror production, not a Black Mirror production, but you know what I mean, directed by Toby Haynes. And then we're going to finish off with Lock Henry, directed by Sam Miller. But before we get into it, I want to talk about this concept of the iconic slash demonic. We're kind of talking about the intersection or the interplay between being iconic, like being famous or prominent in the culture, and having inner demons, having an inner monster that's wanting to unleash itself out on ourselves and the world around us. So we're definitely tapping into things that we've talked about a lot on the show before. We've definitely talked about celebrity and cultural power and cultural leadership in lots of different episodes. And we've also talked about sort of the duality of man and duality as a concept and opposing forces actually being much closer and intertwined than we think. And it's kind of the intersection of those two concepts, particularly in the modern era, which is underpinned by digitization. You know, we live in the digital age. And dare I even say the Instagram age or the TikTok era. And I think one criticism, some of the criticisms that the show is getting with this new season is that like a lot of the episodes kind of lack maybe a technology-centric aspect to them. And I totally see that. And I thought that a little bit myself watching it. But I think when you start to look at the films through this lens of them being set in the digital age and kind of like the main themes and the main ideas that underpin each of the films, they at least have a great deal of that. They're all very applicable to the digital age, and I think some of the insights that we can pull out of these films is certainly something that we can apply to the digital world and the sort of the Instagram era. But let's kick things off now with Uta Brisewitz's Maisie Day. Now, this one centers on a bunch of paparazzis, namely the main one played by Zazie Beetz. And they're going out to get this photo of Maisie Day, who is this famous actor, and she is apparently at this clinic just outside Los Angeles. I think it's actually quite important to touch on before we get started. Little side plot here that it's a drug detox, and I think that is sort of like, while that might not be like the literal reason in the film, I think it's a metaphor. What we see happen to Daisy May is a pretty, I think it's almost quite an obvious metaphor for like what it is to be like in a drug detox. If you've seen the film like Ray with Jamie Foxx, there's some similar imagery. I also think it's really important that if you haven't seen this film, to note what happens at the start. It feels like this, the sort of the back end of this film is sort of completely, I think the things get derailed and it's completely alien from the start. We have to remember at the start of this film, Zazie Beetz goes out and takes a photo of a celebrity, and then he ends up dying. And it's kind of like these two plot points. It's almost like the film is two films, and they're really about the exact same thing. But one is kind of like the literal or like the benign and kind of boring version, and then the second half is kind of like the more cinematic, exciting part of it. And sort of the relationship between paparazzi culture or celebrity culture, being obsessed with celebrities, being obsessed with icons as we certainly are today, you know, Taylor Swift, Kim Kardashian, you know, we've all got one, we've all got a favourite, this sort of suffocating nature of fandom and celebrity, which I think is starting to hit sort of the street level with things like Instagram followers and all that sort of thing. But I think the main point I want to touch on when we talk about Maisie Day is this motif of dualism, or how dualism is kind of inherent to being an icon. And that, I think that's most clearly depicted in the very obvious metaphor of Maisie Day becoming a werewolf. So obviously, you know, and I get it. It's a little bit silly. And I think a lot of people have been like, what was going on here? This is so unrealistic. It's meant to be a show that like freaks people into thinking what could happen. Obviously werewolves aren't real. And I get all that, but I think people should watch this film as if you would watch any film, which is like, you know, we know it's a metaphor, treat it as such. Like, don't just call it stupid because werewolves aren't real. I mean, when you watch Harry Potter, you just sit there the whole time going like, no, there aren't Gryffindors, no, there aren't Voldemorts, no, no one wears glasses at age 10, you know. And I mentioned before the drug detox thing. Telling a story about someone going through a drug detox, you know, would you rather watch that, someone vomiting into a bucket, or someone becoming a werewolf and running around biting people's heads off? It's more exciting, it's more cinematic. And also when we use a metaphor, it's more enriching. There's more to, you know, I like realism and I like realist films, but I also like, I don't mind a bit of supernatural, a bit of metaphorical stuff going on, because it just makes the themes a bit denser. There's more that we can read into them. The insights are a little bit more plump, I think. So when we're talking about werewolves, we're definitely in the realm of the duality of man. We've actually done a whole episode on werewolves. I'm not going to go into that too much. You can go listen to that episode we did many years ago about werewolves and the cinematic lessons that we can learn from films about werewolves. But I think the fact that she's a werewolf is symbolic of the dualistic experience of being famous, right? The kind of cost-benefit dynamic that's inherent to fame. So kind of like with immense popularity comes immense pressure, you know, with idolization, with being put on a pedestal, right? Just react to those words just off the cuff. Like, would you like to be an idol? Because I'm sure like on one hand you're like, oh, it'd be cool to be famous, but also like it'd be kind of suffocating. Everyone's always looking at you. You lose all your privacy and stuff like that. When we use the word idolization or being put on a pedestal, it does have that that bipolar quality to it. So, you know, people are admired, but they're also kind of glorified to a point that, you know, they're seen as more than just mere mortals. And the werewolf specifically, I kind of think, suggests a sense of intensity. And we talk about like why it's good to use metaphors. A werewolf specifically suggests a sense of intensity, that our dark side is kind of proportionate to the intensity of the side that shines. You know, when you think of a werewolf, like, you know, there's a full moon, it's a bright, shining full moon, and then you become this big, scary, hairy, crazy animal. Like we're in the world of extremes, this really bipolar kind of dynamic. And that's kind of what it's like to be, you know, a celebrity on a bender. The full moon comes out, you're going down Hollywood Boulevard or the Sunset Strip or something, you're going wild, right? You think of Charlie Sheen or something like that. There is a kind of werewolfness to that kind of Robert Downey Jr. I'm going out and I'm going crazy as the night, the moon shines upon us, let's say. But what about the side? What about things on the side of the fans, right? Because we've also got this sort of this idea of the opposing causes and consequences of the shot. And you might lose me here if you haven't actually seen the film, but the double entendre that happens with the camera and the gun is very, I think, very relevant. So on one hand, a camera is this kind of ultimate symbol of admiration, isn't it? Because it captures and collects. We take photos of things we want to see again. You know, if we see something we like or someone we like, we want to capture, we want to take a photo of it. It very much is something that complements the subject of our photo. And so we could sort of say, like, when we take photos of celebrities or we scroll through their Instagrams, we're trying to get into their inner lives, their inner personal side, you know, the core version of our heroes, the true version of who they are. We really want to get intimate with them. And this is demanded by the admirers, by the interested, by the curious, by the infatuated, right, by the fans. But as we know, that the camera is also like the trigger that leads to the demise of the admired, of the interesting, right, of the subject, of the people who are curious and infatuated, right, of the famous, right? So it makes a lot of sense that the camera is kind of analogized to a gun. It's a very powerful thing, and it has, again, this dualistic quality where, you know, It can bring life as much as it destroys it all in one go. So the film clearly has a great application to, let's say, like cancel culture, the cancel culture era in a way, because, you know, we're talking about this idea of celebrities having two sides, and, you know, maybe, you know, just on one basic level, the film is kind of like saying that, you know, let's remember to see celebrities as human beings, you know, as much as we love them, there's things about them that, you know, are sinful, and let's not forget that they're just like us, and we all sin, and we all do the wrong thing, we all have our blunders, and let's not hold them against too high a standard. But I think it is more than that. I think what the film is really getting to at the end of the day is contemplating the role of the fan in creating the monster, or in unleashing the monster, or in conjuring the monster, even if it's the very thing that we don't want to see. The fans can be the thing that enlivens the inner demon, the inner demon that one day, ironically, might be unleashed and destroy the very person that we're admiring. So when we watch a film like this, bottom line, we get a feeling that it's obviously bad when we kind of put so much pressure on the Britney Spears of the world for their inner demons to emerge and become kind of self-destructive. But, like, can we say that about everyone, right? Like, can we know the full extent of how that all works if we don't compare that to someone who, let's say, isn't an icon? You know, what if we were to put the magnifying glass on someone who's the complete opposite of Britney Spears, someone who nobody knows? Well, before we talk about that, let this remind you, dear listener, you are listening to 2XX 98.3 FM on the People Powered Radio Station. This is Sacred Cinema for the remainder of this half-hour slot. And please stay tuned for more quality radio content afterwards. And also jump onto our website to consider sponsoring the show or subscribing to 2XX. We'd love it if you could do that. My inner demons won't come out if you do that. Let's put it that way. So the next film we're going to talk about is Demon 79. This is the one directed by Toby Haynes. And the plot centers around Nida, who's this quiet girl who works at a shoe shop. She's bullied by everyone. She doesn't really have any friends. She doesn't really have any family. Like, her mother's passed away. She's very meek and shy. And she accidentally summons a demon who tells her that she has to kill three people. And so we have a very classical, archetypal, canonical dilemma where the pure of heart, shy, uncontroversial, rule-abiding young girl is required to engage that inner, dark and monstrous side to protect, to better individuate herself. And there's got a, you know, it's a very Beauty and the Beast, Shrek, Babadook, pretty much every modern movie with a female lead about, you know, embracing that inner masculine side. I mean, obviously the devil is, the demon character is played by, not obviously, but he's played by a man, and he's a big, tall guy. He's very charismatic. He's kind of everything she isn't. Right? He's dressed up like Bonnie Abbey. He's very stylish. He's a very cool guy. She's like all the things. He's in all of her deficiencies. Her anima, you could say, is this guy. And by embracing him, she learns, you know, how to become her truest self and not take any crap from other people. But I don't want to just limit this film to just being another story of individuation, of becoming whole by, I mean, I feel like we talk about that every second week on this show. I think what's really interesting about this film, and it's got a very clear political bent, and I'm going to try and steer it clear from being just like pure leftist propaganda, even though I think it can serve us well in that respect, if that's what you want it to be. But that's sort of not for everyone, I suppose. Let's try and sort of look at sort of the kind of maybe like the broader implications of this and kind of what it says about like what it is, what happens like on the broader stage, let's say, when shy little ladies don't learn to embrace their inner demons. Because on one hand, he's be like, well, you know what, I just don't feel like doing it and I'm the only one that's going to bear the brunt of that. Well, no, there are political implications. And I think it's quite important to the film that she's like a migrant and there's this local politician who's like a very like stereotypical populist. And it kind of comes to the case that like if she's not the one to stop him, like she's got to kill someone. Like if it's not him, she gets this premonition from the demon, like what he could end up doing. So it's got this really nice symbolic quality of like, you can't really just stand by and let people in the political, even though it's not fair, you can't really let people stand by and trample over you just because you're shy. But you've actually got to be the one that sort of stands up and does something about it. But then there's also like broader geopolitical implications as well. Like it's not just for people who live in like small British localities. There's a broader geopolitical implication. If the meek and mild people don't embrace their inner demons, we've only got the macho psychos running the world. And what happens if we don't have sort of that diversity of personalities? We don't have that diversity or that balance, that duality, I should say. That kind of tree of life structure, where we have both sort of competence and compassion working together. You know, this one's set in 1979 as the backdrop of nuclear war, and it's weirdly apt considering that Oppenheimer just came out. And also, living in Sydney, you know, Sydney Theatre Company just put on, and I think it's still on the Beach, which also had this nuclear thing going. And I actually went and saw it the other day, and I heard someone in front of me go, like, isn't this weird that this has come out at the same time as Oppenheimer? And it feels like there's something in the air, like the culture is kind of asking, like, well, who's actually going to step up? And loyal fans of the show know that we've discussed this when we talked about, we did that episode on Gattaca and Interstellar and Sunshine, and being like, on some level, people need to, like, make a decision to be the one to take on the sacrifice of making sure we don't lead ourselves to utter destruction, because we're currently geared to die. Like, if the world continues the way it's going, it will end. So somebody from a different camp, someone from that opposite side of the field needs to step up. And in this case, it's NIDA. So as to say, like, it's not only in the interests of these little individuals to embrace that inner monster, but we all sort of count on you, right? If you're out there listening, the little meek and mild person that kind of needs to embrace that little, that inner demon a bit more, we're all counting on you. We need someone like you to balance things out. We need to let, and I mean, I think this film does get into some stereotypical quality with the sort of the stereotypical white Englishman, but you could look at that politician character as maybe like an archetypally conservative or archetypally privileged person, which sort of calls to arms the archetypally, you know, progressive, I guess. Whatever, if we have prominent figures, we need to have their equal opposites up there challenging them, critiquing them, making sure that things are balanced and aren't getting skewed one way or another. And I suppose that's why you want to, I don't want this to just serve sort of a leftist framework, because I think it does go both ways. Like, you always need to have some kind of balance there, I think, in a sort of Hegelian dialectical way. But I think there's also another aspect of this film I really liked, was that by the end of the film, it doesn't depict this kind of embrace of the inner demon as like a walk in the park. It's not as simple as just like, now I'm going to yell and scream and be angry at people. It's not a walk in the park, but it's not all that bad either. I think the ending of this film, without giving too much away if you haven't seen it, it certainly perpetuates the idea of like a, we talked a second ago about like a dialectical or a Hegelian kind of balancing act. Like, it does perpetuate this idea of a middle way, like a somewhat like ultimately synthesized, somewhere in between heaven and hell, where that's kind of the place you end up if you dare to take on this burden. It's almost like a place where the most pure selves, the most pure self lives in harmony with our most evil self, if that kind of makes sense. I think that's kind of the lasting image of this film. So it's left us in a funny place, isn't it? Because on one hand, we want to avoid the demons of icons rearing in their face and being unleashed, but equally, it's almost like things are in perfect proportion. Like if we also need non-iconic people to unleash their demons, despite the fact that we don't want iconic people to do so. So is there a realistic way that we can depict this ideal balancing act, balance these two nations in a kind of realistic way? Well, let's finish off now with Locke Henry, which is probably the most like, which is definitely the most like realist film of the three. It has the least amount of supernatural qualities. In fact, I don't think it has any. And it centers on a young filmmaker. His name is Davis, and his girlfriend Pia, and they set out to make a true crime documentary about a murderer in Davis's hometown. And we're going to specifically focus on Davis just because I think it works better for this week's conversation. And there's a lot we could say about the Pia character as well, but I think if you've seen the film, I don't want to give too much away, so we'll just park her character for a little bit. And I think we could talk about this one being the transformation from being the meek and mild, being insignificant, to being iconic, because he's this wannabe filmmaker. So he wants to have like on one hand, he is a very meek and mild kind of guy at the start. Like he's got Scottish guy, lives in the Highlands, and he's like a frail kind of film nerd, but he obviously wants to be a filmmaker, so he's got these big dreams and he's willing to employ a great deal of grit to go far, and he also certainly has sort of his literal inner demons, in the sense that he has his father's passed away and the father was somehow involved, and I'll leave it at that, in terms of how he was sort of involved with this crime, this true crime thing that they're trying to uncover. So you do have this duality in the Davis character, these competing sides, which he's sort of a quiet, meek and mild guy, but he has these big dreams. He has to sort of climb a very tall mountain to get where he's going. And this could have very simply been a very stereotypical cliche hero's journey about the cost of success, where through pain and hard work, through grit, one goes into their dark side and finally gets what they want through great determination and perseverance. You get what you want, you know, a real sort of chariots of fire arc. And I'm not going to say that the film doesn't do that. It actually uses plenty of very stereotypical cliche images and moments to tell a story about the tale of success. He goes to a dark and scary place. He has to be brave. He gets the touching support from his initially somewhat apprehensive mother, but everything she does is out of love, and you know, it's ultimately her love and the loving side to her that gets him to the place that he needs to be. And so he has the support of his family. He wins the big award, and he puts his hometown back on the map, and he doesn't lose ties with his roots. You know, it is the classic hero's journey. But in no way does this feel like the classic story of the hero's arc by the end of it. In fact, it's honestly, and I don't want to talk too much about how, because I try and keep things as analytical as possible in this show, but I have to commend Brooker and I suppose Sam Miller as well on just how remarkable the feel of this is, despite the fact that you have all of those very cliche and stereotypical plot points. It doesn't feel anything like that by the end of the film. And that's, I guess, that's one of the great symptoms or one of the great consequences of great writing and filmmaking. I think to describe this film, and it does actually use a lot of like landscape imagery as well, which kind of works with this metaphor, but you could say that it kind of has the quality of like a very pretty picture with lots of people maybe like having a picnic or something. But everyone's who should be there is there. But it's almost like some of the characters have been flipped around or they're upside down or the colours of them are all wrong. Like everything, all the pieces that you need to tell the story about someone that has to embrace and be gritty and go deep into themselves and for the ugly things of their past to rear their heads, it has all those moments, but it doesn't feel nice at the end. It doesn't feel like something that we would be glad to have done. So it's kind of got this sense of like from afar, everything is there that is usually there, but the overall feeling is utterly depressing and doesn't make us feel like the whole endeavor was something that we actually necessarily would advocate for if it was someone that we loved. Sort of supposed to say that like the price of controlling or dare I say even like exploiting our inner demons is not simply hard work, right? It's not simply just doing the job that needs to be done. But it is so agonizing that you wonder whether it was all worth it. And this is certainly something that we could take from sort of Nietzschean philosophy. And you could also see sort of things like, I know Slavoj Žižek talks a lot about, you know, that life is dull and suffering. And you've got people like Woody Allen that talk about it. But sometimes it's a very romantic depiction of, you know, the struggle of the artist is difficult. No, the struggle of the artist destroys you. Or at least it can. Like, the level of sacrifice isn't simply hard work and blood and sweat, but something that really destroys your sense of being, your sense of belonging, your sense of who you are. You lose sight of the people you love and what matters to you, to the point that when you're sitting there on the couch with the BAFTA and the glass of champagne, you're wondering what it's all for. So let's kind of try and tie everything together, because I don't want to leave things in too depressing. I want to keep things sort of light enough that people want to sort of push forward in life, but also being serious and being serious about what we're doing here. I think in Maisie Day we explored this idea that the idea of the celebrity is riddled with contradictions, where it almost feels as if the more that we inflate the people we admire, the more we want them to be prominent, the more we expand their prominence, the more we provoke their inner demons. It's like this level of proportionality where, you know, the more you inflate the balloon, the louder the bang's going to be when it bursts. But if we're in that sort of realm of proportionality, I think the same goes for the opposite, in the sense that the sort of the less iconic someone is, kind of the more we need them to embrace that inner demon, which we sort of explored when we talked about Demon 79, and that it is sort of benefit, and it reminds me a little bit of what we talked about a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about going back in time. It's like if you the proportionality, the degree to which you benefited from the past is proportionate to how little you should go back to get things from it, and kind of the less that you benefited from the past, the more that you should go back to get things from it, in a way. It's a bit like that. The less iconic you are, the more that you need to sort of see the benefit or embrace that inner demon, and also not just for yourself, but for the state. And because the world kind of depends on it. But that also, that still leads to a kind of tragic injustice in a way, because, why should you have to do that? That's a difficult thing. But when you think about what's at stake, somebody needs to sacrifice on some level. And speaking of nuclear war and things like that, I think also the Tarkovsky film, The Sacrifice, literally called The Sacrifice, certainly could be put on the same spectrum as Demon 79, the same ballpark. I think it definitely deals with the same kind of themes. That could be a great quadruple feature. You go Oppenheimer, Demon 79, On the Beach, and The Sacrifice. But speaking of sacrifice and what it means, it's not just a romantic thing. It's not just, I went out there and I gave it my all, and I left everything out in the park and it feels good and now I can relax in the ice bath. When we talked about Locke Henry, we try really hard not to miscategorize what sacrifice looks like in that journey from going from insignificance to iconic. To use one's demons, right, to embrace them in that useful way. If you want to be an artist and you want to tell stories and you want to go into that dark place, if you want to go back into your history and your family's history and who you are and the people you love and what they're all about, that is not without its downside. And it's not simply the fact that you have to, face your fears and deal with a pumping heart rate and have to go into a dark room and maybe see something scary or look at a scary video or look at a confronting image. It's something that will be, could be, or at least the point that I think the film is trying to make, what it's trying to make us remember through the use of cinema, is to say that it's not a romantic sense of sacrifice all the time. Sometimes it's something that will make you feel utterly depressed, that will make you scared to think about who you actually are and where you actually come from. It's almost as if when we do that, when we want to go into that place to become more iconic, it's almost as if we're looking into a mirror. And the more iconic we become, the darker the inner demon will be staring right back at us. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we've got this week here on Say Good Cinema on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. Stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX FM, and also consider jumping onto our website to sponsor the show or subscribe to the station. All of that would be very much appreciated. But thanks so much for tuning in, and please get in contact with me. You can email me at contact@jimmybernasconi.com if you've got anything to say to me whatsoever. I'll see you again next week.